This is Nick Treadwell, and you are listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Chapter 2. His name was Remo, and the man was throwing a punch at him. He was actually throwing a punch. Remo watched it. Years before, a punch had been something fast that you ducked or blocked, or saw suddenly at the end of a fist banging into your head with hurt. Now it was almost ridiculous. There was this very big man. He was 6 feet 4 inches tall. He had big shoulders and big arms, a very big chest and drive hammer thighs. He wore oil-covered dungarees, a checkered shirt and thick hobnailed boots. He worked driving cut-down trees, forest to mill in Oregon. And no, he wasn't going to stay for another 20 minutes at the eat-out diner stop just so some old gook could finish writing some letter. The faggy guy in the black t-shirt had better haul that dinky yellow car out of the way or he would run it over. No? Well then, skinny man, I'm going to have to pulverize you, said the log driver. And then the punch started. The man was much bigger than Remo, outweighing him by more than 100 pounds. The man awkwardly set his balance and started his bulk toward Remo, bringing a big, hairy fist ponderously around from behind him, driving with his legs and throwing his whole body into the blow. People from the diner ran out to see the skinny fellow with the foreigner get murdered by Hulk Hubbley, who had already put more men in the hospital than you could shake a homelight chainsaw at. Waiting for the punch, Remo pondered his options. There was nothing miraculous about it. A few top hitters could see the seams of a baseball as it whizzed toward them from the pitcher. Basketball players could feel hoops they could not see, and skiers could hear the consistency of snow they had not yet skied on. These people did it with natural talent that had accidentally been developed to a minor degree. Remo's skills had been worked, reworked, honed, and blossomed under the tutelage of more than 3,000 years of wisdom, so that while average persons with deadened senses saw blurs, Remo saw knuckles and bodies moving not in slow motion, but almost in still photographs. There was big Hulk Hubbley threatening. There was the crowd coming out to see Remo get pulverized, and then began the long, slow punch. In the back of the yellow Toyota, Chayan, the master of Sinanju, with skin as wrinkled as parchment and wisps of white hair gracing his frail-appearing head, leaned over a writing pad, his long plumed goose quill pen scratching away. He was creating a great saga of love and beauty. Chayan had trained Remo. He therefore had every right to expect peace and quiet, and that undue noise should not be made while he was composing his thoughts. First, he imagined the great love affair between the king and the courtesan, and then he penned the words. The only thing he wanted from outside the car was quiet. Remo realized this, and as the punch came, like a slow train rumbling into a station, Remo gently put his right hand under the oncoming arm, so that the man would not grunt loudly. Remo compressed the lungs evenly by thrusting his left arm across the stomach and his left knee behind the back so the big Hulk Hubbley looked as if he suddenly had a skinny human pretzel wrapped around him. who cubbily felt explosively piqued. He had swung, and now he was out of breath. With his right fist held up in the air, and like a statue that could not move, he was falling on that hand, and by Jiminy, the hand was being forced open, changing from a fist to catch his body, and he was rolling on the ground out of breath, and there was a foot on his throat, a black loafer with green gum on its sole, to be exact, and the guy in the grey flannels and the black T-shirt was standing over him. "Shh," whispered Remo. "You get air for quiet, quiet for air. It's a trade, sweetheart." The man didn't say all right, but Remo knew he meant all right. His body meant it. Remo let some air into the man's lungs as the big face reddened. Then, like kicking on an engine, Remo compressed the lungs gently once more and they opened full, sucking in a large and blessed supply of oxygen for Hook Hubley, who lay there still on the diner driveway. Hearing the sucking gasp for air, Chion looked up from his writing pad. "Please," he said.
"Sorry," said Remo.
"Not everyone can write a love story," he said.
"Sorry," said Remo.
"When a man gives the wisdom of the ages to a coarse gruntling, the least the gruntling can do is keep a certain quiet about places where important things are being done."
"I said I'm sorry, little father."
"Sorry? Sorry? Sorry?" mumbled Chion. "Sorry for this, sorry for that. Propriety does not require a sorry. Correctness means never having to say you're sorry."
"So I'm not sorry," said Remo.
"I'm out here tending to this guy so he won't make noise, stopping him from starting his truck so it won't make noise, because I want you to be disturbed. See? I'm cunning about it. I'm not sorry at all. Never have been. I'm inconsiderate." "I knew that," said Chion. "Now I cannot write."
"You haven't written for a month on that thing. You just stare at it day after day. You're using everything for an excuse. I stopped that truck and this guy just so you'll face the fact that you're not a writer."
"There are no good love stories around today. The great dramas of your television have degenerated into nothing. They have violence, even sex. This is a pure love story. Not cows and bulls reproducing, but love. I understand love because I know and I care enough not to be disturbed by people at productive work."
"Not for a month, little father."
"Not a word." "Because you make a noise."
"No noise," said Remo.
"Noise," said Chion,
and tore up his pad with a flurry of his sharp fingernails. He slid his hand into the sleeves of the opposite arms of his kimono.
"I cannot compose while you carp."
Remo massaged Hulk Hubley's chest with his foot. Hubley felt a lot better. Well, good enough to get to his feet. Good enough to take another poke at the skinny guy. Skinny guy hardly noticed him. Just a little bit, enough to be where the punch was not. It was the strangest thing. Skinny guy didn't duck, didn't dodge, didn't block a punch, just wasn't there when the fist was. "Even if you got it down on paper, which you won't, nobody's interested in love stories in this country. They want sex."
"There is nothing new to sex," said Chion. "Sex does not change from emperor to peasant, from pharaoh to your cab drivers. Babies are made very much the same as they have always been made."
"Well, still Americans like to read about it."
"Why? Can't they do it? You people seem to breed well enough. There are so many of you, almost all of you, with meat on your breath and insults on your tongue making noise."
You want to sell a book, little father? Write about sex.
That takes up less than one page, said Cheyenne,
his eyebrows furrowing in worry.
The seed meets the egg and the baby happens, or the seed does not meet the egg and the baby does not happen. This is a subject for a book. The white mind is mysterious.
Remo turned back to Hubley, who was still throwing punches. The crowd on the diner steps now was cheering Remo on and laughing at Hubley.
Enough. No more games, said Remo to Hubley. All right, you son of a bitch. I'll show you what no more game is.
Big Hulk Hubley went to the cab of his truck. From underneath the seat, he pulled out a sawed-off shotgun. It could shiver a telephone pole in two, or mutilate a wall. At close range, sawed-off shotguns made people chopped liver. The folks on the porch stopped laughing at Hulk Hubley. That made him feel better. That was what he wanted, respect. And he was going to get it from that skinny fellow, too.
Put that away, said Remo mildly. You can hurt with that. That's not nice playing.
Apologize, said Hulk Hubley. So he would do a few years in the state pen if he had to for sausaging that guy. So what? Lots of loggers had done time. Time didn't make a man no different. Time nowadays was just about the same as not doing time, now that they had you out in the forests working. You could get yourself a woman in prison if you had the right connections and you kept your smarts. So why not kill the guy? Unless, of course, he apologized. But then an even stranger thing happened. Sure, it was mighty peculiar that the skinny guy couldn't be hit by a punch, not even right up close. Sometimes so close the knuckles felt the black T-shirt, and they had the chest right there in the path of a good punch, and then it was gone. That was peculiar enough, but now something else even weirder happened. And Hulk Hubley would swear for many a year afterward that this thing really happened. As soon as he had decided he was going to pull the trigger without saying anything different, without making any special move, the old Oriental lifted his head as if he were a mind reader. The skinny white guy stopped his conversation with the Oriental and also looked. At the very same time, as if both of them knew instantly what had gone on inside Hulk Hubley's mind.
No, said the white guy.
Better not. Hulk Hubley didn't threaten, didn't smile, just stood there with his right trigger figure cradling that deadly strip of metal that could send a wall of shot out at the yellow Toyota and the two men. It was a quiet moment. Then, suddenly, the old gook wasn't in the seat anymore, and Hulk Hubley could swear all he did was try to get a peek at where the old guy was, and then he didn't see anything. There was this bright light above, and this fellow with a green mask, and the place smelled of ether. If this was the diner driveway, why was there a ceiling above him? His back was on a very hard thing, and someone was talking to a nurse. And there were now three people with green masks and green caps looking down at him. And someone was saying something about a local anesthetic, and someone was coming too. Hulk Hubley realized that it was he who was coming too. The people looking down at him were doctors. He could hear their problem, something about rectal canals and two unfired shells in the chamber. And the trigger guard being inside. They would have to cut it, because a yank might explode the shells. And then a doctor noticed Hulk was aware of what was going on.
Mister, he said, would you mind telling us how you got a sawed-off shotgun loaded into your intestinal tract? I mean, how did you do it without the thing going off? I know this model. It's got a hair trigger. How did you do it?
You won't believe it, but I think it was because I had a nasty thought.
In downtown Portland, Remo waited by a telephone booth, looking at his watch. He did not need to tell the time, but he needed it to make sure that upstairs was telling the time correctly. In one hand he had a dime, and in the other hand he had a telephone number. He was no good at this code thing, and the only time it worked for people was when they were code people themselves. Remo suspected that every intelligence agency or secret organization had a code nut. Nobody else understood what the code nut was up to, except other code nuts, often in completing services. These code nuts made their codes more and more complicated to prevent other code nuts on the other side from understanding them. Meanwhile, the people who had to use those things went stumbling along, guessing at what was what. If Remo understood what upstairs wanted, then the third number in the telephone number was the number of times he should let the number ring before phoning back, and the fourth number was the time of day he should phone. The third number was 2, and the fourth number was 5. Remo made a mental bet with himself. The bet was 3-1 he would not reach upstairs correctly. A man with a blue snap-brimmed hat and eyeglasses was using the phone. He carried a cane over his arm.
"Sir," said Remo, "I'm sort of in a rush. Would you let me use the phone, please?"
The man shook his head. He said to someone on the other end of the line to go ahead. He was in no hurry. Remo hung up for him. He wedged the head and the hat between phone box and wall. The eyeglasses popped up to the man's eyebrow. He grunted. He could not make clear sounds because his jaw was wedged open. He sounded like he was in a dentist's chair. Remo dialed the number, waited for 2 rings, hung up and dialed again. He was sure it wasn't going to work.
"Yes?" came the acidic voice.
It had worked. Remo unwedged the man's head.
"Sorry," he said. "You're going to have to hobble away. I need privacy. I didn't think I'd reach my party, but, you know, I did. Thanks."
He gave the man back his cane and told him to work his jaw and the pain would go away.
"Who was that?" asked the voice on the other end of the line.
The voice was that of Harold W. Smith, head of Cure, and to Remo, a man who worried too much about too many things.
"Somebody got his head caught between the phone and the wall. This is not the sort of place for conversation that should be carried out in public.
I'm alone. He's gone."
Did you kill him?
"What is this? Come on. What's the message?"
"You might not want to leave so many bodies around."
Remo quickly scribbled on a pad. This new system for messages was supposed to have been simplified so that he could understand it. By transposing words instead of letters, and every word at a different integer on the card, to be translated into another word, he was now supposed to be able to get quickly and easily a coded message that no one else could interpret. He had the card and his pencil out, along with a piece of paper. He put the message together.
"What do you want me to do in Albuquerque?"
"That wasn't the message," said Smith. "Here is the message."
"Jerk," mumbled Remo.
"Bluebellies, Boston, Globe 19, and Zebra. Got it?"
"Yep," said Remo.
"Does it make sense?"
"Not at all," said Remo.
"Not even slightly."
"All right, 54 dancers, break 3 dowels."
"Gotcha," said Remo. "I'll be there."
He hung up and put the code card in his rear pocket. It looked like a bank calendar with descriptions of very peculiar loan rates. He was to meet Smith at the Logan Airport shuttle room in Boston. Cheyenne was in the Toyota. He was busy not writing his tale of the king's love. How could he be expected to compose beauty with Remo ramming dimes into a telephone?
"We're going to Boston," said Remo.
"That is the other side of your country."
"Right.
How can I write when we go shifting from one side of this country to another?"
asked Cheyenne. On the flight to Boston, he mentioned 7 times how a true artist could not write while traveling. How, if he were not traveling, he would have completed his novel by now. How this was the very best time to write, and it might never come again. If it weren't for this trip and its chaos, he would have done the book. But now it was over, forever, because of Remo. Not that Cheyenne was in the habit of blaming, he mentioned. He just wanted things understood. He was not blaming Remo, but Remo might just as well have set fire to Cheyenne's manuscript. A manuscript that probably was superior to William Shakespeare's, a famous white writer. Cheyenne mentioned famous white writers because if he mentioned Hack Low, Remo would ask who Hack Low was. Remo wasn't asking who Hack Low was. A man with a big grin, a checkered suit, and a gold keychain adorning his expanse of suede vest apologized for listening into someone else's conversation. But could the fine gentleman in the kimono possibly tell him who Hack Low was? He was interested and did not know. Remo put the man's unfinished luncheon compote, served in plastic dishes by the stewardess, into the man's grinning face. Not hard, but the plastic bowl did crack. It was not asked again on the flight across the continent who Hack Low was. Remo remained happily unknowing. At Logan Airport in Boston, Cheyenne quoted a few lines from Hack Low.
"Oh, torpid blossom, that meanders through thine unctuous morning. Let thy preambulant breezes cusp like the dalliance of a last breathed life."
"That," Cheyenne said proudly, "is Hack Loyan."
"That is icky mess," said Remo.
"You are a barbarian,"
said Cheyenne. His voice was high and squeaky, angrier than normal.
"Because I don't like what I don't like, I don't care if you think America is such a new backward country. My opinion is as good as anyone else's. Anyone's. Especially yours. You're just an assassin like me. You're no better."
"Just an assassin?"
asked Cheyenne, overwhelming horror seizing him. He stopped. The fold of the light blue kimono fluttered like a tree being hit by one sudden gust of breeze. They were at the entrance to the shuttle terminal of Logan Airport.
"Just an assassin?"
Cheyenne squeaked in English.
"More than a decade of millennia of wisdom poured into an unworthy white vessel? A stupid white vessel that calls an assassin just an assassin? There are just poets, and there are just kings, and there are just wealthy men. There are never just assassins."
"Just?" said Remo. People in their rush to catch their hourly flights to New York City stopped to look. Cheyenne's arms waved, and the grace of the kimono flowed like a flag in a wind tunnel. Remo, whose casual balance and strong face tended to weaken most women, often with desires they had not known they had, looked even sharper and turned like a cat toward Cheyenne. And there they argued. Dr. Harold W. Smith, whose public identity was the director of Folcroft's Sanitarium,
the cover for the organization and home of its massive computer banks, looked over his neatly folded New York Times at the two men fighting. One his lone killer arm, the other his Oriental trainer, and regretted meeting in a public place. So secret was the organization, only one man, Remo, was allowed to kill, and only Smith, each American president, and Remo himself knew exactly what the organization did. More often than not, the organization would pass up a necessary mission because of fear of exposure. Secrecy was more important for CUA than for the CIA because the CIA was constitutionally licensed to operate. But CUA had been set up in violation of the Constitution to do things. And now, with terror as deep as the marrow of his bones, Smith watched his killer arm loudly talking about assassins. And just in case anyone should not be interested, there was Chion, the master of Sin and Jew, and the most recent descendant of a line of more than 2,000 years of master assassins, in Oriental garb, screaming, his parchment face red. Screaming about assassins, Smith wanted to crawl into the pages of his New York Times and disappear. A highly rational man, he understood that most people would not comprehend that the two were really killers, and they had ways of getting through people and official forces that was miraculous. The danger now was that Smith would be seen talking to Remo. He would have to abort his mission. He folded his newspaper and blended himself into the line of passengers headed toward New York. He turned his head away from the arguing pair who had not seen him. He looked out at the airport runways beneath this circular terminal for the shuttle flights. He became quite interested in the smog over Boston. He was almost at the ramp to the plane when he felt a tap on his shoulder. It was Remo. "No, I don't have a match," said Smith. This would let Remo know that everything was off. Smith could not afford to be identified with such an attention-drawing scene as Remo had just irresponsibly created. "Come on, Smitty," said Remo. To stand there and deny he knew Remo would draw even more attention. Feeling as though his blood was drained from his limbs, Smith got out of line. He ignored Chion's formal sweeping bow and kept walking. All three got into a cab to Boston. "Everyone can have half fare. If it's a group fare, it's cheaper," said the cabbie. "Quiet," said Smith. For the first time, Remo noticed how Smith's gray suit and vest were so confining. He had never thought the man needed to be unconfined. Probably the only baby born with constipation and a sour disposition. "And that goes for you two also," said Smith. "Quiet, please." "Listen," said the cabbie. "This is our new community rate to bring you the community, a more equitable transportation service within the economic grasp of all." "That's pretty good," said Remo. "I thought so," said the cabbie. "Do you use your ears?"
"Yes."
"Then use them now. I'm not going to give you that rate, but if you interrupt me again, I'm going to put your earlobes in your lap. This is a very sincere promise," said Remo.
"Remo!"
said Smith sharply. The bloodless face paled even more.
"Merely an assassin," said Cheyenne,
staring at the grit and brick of North End Boston.
"There are 100,000 doctors, most of whom will do you harm, but they are not just doctors."
Remo looked at Smith and shrugged. "I don't know what you're getting upset about."
"Very many things," said Smith. "You've been creating problems."
"Life's a problem," said Remo.
"Every country has a king or a president or an emperor. Never has there been a country without one. Yet few have good assassins, a blessing and a rarity. Who talks of just an emperor? Well, indeed, it is truly just an emperor. An emperor is merely an untrained person who usually did nothing more than be correctly born. But an assassin? Ah, the training for a real assassin, said Cheyenne. I don't want to talk about this in public, said Smith. That's one of our problems.
Not mine, said Remo.
An idiot can write a book, said Cheyenne. That is no great accomplishment when one has time and is not bothered by noisy whites. But who says just a writer? Anyone can write, given quiet and no disturbances, but an assassin?
Please, both of you, said Smith.
But what? Asked Remo. Cheyenne was talking also, said Smith.
Oh, said Remo. Hearing that he should keep quiet, Cheyenne turned his frail head to Smith. Although normally excessively polite to anyone who employed the House of Sin and Jew, this time was another matter. Every few centuries there was an emperor loose-tongued enough to tell a master of Sin and Jew to be quiet. It was not the wisest move and was never repeated. Giving loyalty was one thing, allowing abuse another. Smith saw Cheyenne stare, that incredibly deep quiet. It was beyond a threat. It was as if for the first time Smith had been exposed to the terrible, awesome force of the tiny old Oriental, because he had stepped over some invisible line. Smith had faced death before and had been afraid, yet faced it and did what he had to do. It was not fear he felt this time, looking at the stillness of the master of Sin and Jew. It was like being naked and unprepared in the face of creation. It was like Judgment Day, and he was wrong. He had gone into a wrong place because he had made that incredible mistake of taking the master of Sin and Jew lightly and for granted.
I'm sorry, said Smith. I apologize.
Cheyenne did not answer right away. It seemed like ages to Smith, but finally the old head bowed, indicating the apology was accepted. Somehow, an apology was not necessary for Remo. Smith could not explain it, but it was so. In a small restaurant, Smith ordered a meal. Remo and Cheyenne said they wanted nothing. Smith ordered the cheapest spaghetti and meatballs, then waved a chrome rod around the table.
No bugs, he said. I guess we're safe.
Remo, I am vastly unhappy about the public way, the attention-attracting way you're doing your job.
Okay, then let's call it a day. I've been with you doing work that no other man could do. Too long. Too many hotel rooms, too many ping-pong codes, too many emergencies, and too many places where no one knows me.
It's not that simple, Remo, said Smith. We need you. Your country needs you. I know that matters to you.
Oh, spit, said Remo.
That doesn't matter to me at all. The only person who ever gave me anything in my life is...
I'm not going to go into it, said Remo. But it ain't you, Smitty.
Cheyenne smiled. Thank you, he said.
What can I say, asked Smith, other than, you know, things are not going well for your country. We've had hard times.
So have I, said Remo. I don't know how to put this, and I'm really at a loss for words, said Smith. We not only need you, but we need you in a special manner. You have been attracting attention, and we can't afford it.
How? Said Remo belligerently.
For instance, there was a television show on the news last night. Someone had given some pottery maker out in Portland, Oregon, a yellow Toyota, ownership papers and everything, because he didn't feel like parking it, and he was with an old Oriental.
Old? Questioned Cheyenne. Is the mighty oak old because it is not a green sap-spewing twig?
No, said Smith. Sorry, but that's what the television said. He turned back to Remo. Now, I know you just gave that Toyota away. I know it was you. You bought it to drive around and then you got to the airport and you didn't feel like parking it. So you gave it to some good-looking woman who was passing by. What should I have done? Drive it into the Pacific? Burn it? Explode it? You should have done something that wouldn't get some news announcer talking about it. How's this for a great Mother's Day gift, folks? We were late for the plane. Park it or sell it for $50. You ever try selling a car worth several thousand dollars for $50? No one would buy it. They wouldn't trust it. Or the scene in the airport lounge, said Smith.
Yes, this time I must agree with our most beautiful Emperor Smith, said Cheyenne, who called anyone who employed him Emperor. He is right. What instantly prompted you in a public place before a multitude of people to say, just an assassin? How could you have done such an irresponsible and thoughtless thing? Pray tell, what? Explain yourself, Remo.
Remo didn't answer. He made a motion with his hands that he wanted to hear the assignment. He heard the story of Dr. Sheila Feinberg and how people were killed as if by a tiger. Two deaths don't really bother us, said Smith. That's not the worry. It never is, said Remo bitterly. What makes this different is the human beings, the human race as we know it, might just be facing extinction. The spaghetti and meatballs came and Smith was quiet. When the waiter was gone, Smith continued. We have a defense mechanism in our bodies that fights disease. Our best minds believe that whatever transformed Dr. Feinberg has broken down those defense mechanisms. Basically, what they're talking about is a microbe more deadly than a nuclear weapon. Cheyenne smoothed his robe. Remo noticed the paintings in the restaurant were done on the wall. The artist had used a lot of green. We don't think the police can properly handle it. You've got to isolate this Dr. Feinberg, then isolate what she has apparently accidentally discovered. Otherwise, I think mankind is going under.
It's been going under since we climbed out the trees, said Remo.
Worse this time. Those animal genes shouldn't have affected her, but they did. Somehow, there was an unlocking process which enabled different genes to mix. Now, if that can be done, then there's no telling what might happen. There might be a disease for which man has no immunity, or there might be a race created much stronger than man. Remo, I mean it. This whole thing is perhaps more menacing to mankind than anything that's ever happened in the history of the species.
You know they put sugar in that tomato sauce, said Remo, pointing to the white strands of pasta buried under a rich red mound of tomato sauce.
Maybe you haven't heard what I said, but you two should know this thing could destroy the world, including Sin and Jew, said Smith.
I beg your pardon, I didn't hear you, said Cheyenne. Would you repeat that last sentence, please, O gracious Emperor?